Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
You know, what's the literal next step I need to take to work out logistics of going to Juneau?
Candidates in close races wait for Wednesday's ranked choice results. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Monday, November 21st. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, Bering Sea crabbers hope to get federal relief funds.
If you're going to have a fishery disaster request program, you should be able to make it so that money is getting into the hands of those affected very, very quickly.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The polls have closed on the November 8th general election. Preliminary results have been released online by the Alaska Division of Elections. Final results will not be posted until Wednesday, November 23rd, giving time for all ballots postmarked by Election Day to be counted, including mail ballots from rural Alaska, from college students in the lower 48, and from Alaskans serving in the military abroad. This message sponsored by Alaskans for Better Elections.
Alaskans are used to waiting a while for election results, but this year is a little different. With the new ranked choice voting system, there's a 15-day wait between Election Day and ranked choice tabulation. As Alaska Public Media's Kavitha George reports, many candidates in close races have been left waiting in limbo and won't get answers until Wednesday.
Ranked choice voting has changed how candidates campaign and how Alaskans vote. It's also changed the pace of our election cycle. Previously, on election night or shortly after, most candidates had a pretty good sense of where they stood. This year, when so much hinges on how voters ranked their second or third choices, it's much more unclear how close races will shake out. So those would-be legislators have just had to wait it out.
No, I have no predictions.
Republican Kathy Geisel is running in a three-way race for a South Anchorage State Senate seat. She and her opponents, incumbent Republican Roger Holland and Democrat Rosalind Casey, each have about a third of the vote. Geisel is slightly ahead, but her path to victory depends on how many voters ranked her second on their ballots. She says while she thinks 15 days might be a little excessive, she's happy to wait to find out.
I've been prepared all along that it would take a while. Alaska waits the longest for those absentee ballots to come in of any state.
In the meantime, Geisel says she's been attending resource development conferences, sending out her newsletter, and catching up on less political activities.
I'm also doing some quilting, which I haven't been able to do for a while, and painting some rooms in my house. And I just finished refinishing some furniture that I've been wanting to refinish. So, yes, doing lots of fun things, too.
It's a similar situation for Maxine Dybert, a Democrat running for state house for the first time in Fairbanks. She has just under 50% of first-choice votes, and the rest is split between her Republican opponents, incumbent Bart LeBon and Kelly Nash.
Being in a purple district, I am a little bit on pins and needles, just kind of waiting.
Dybert says she knew it was going to be close. In 2018, LeBon won his race by a single vote against his Democratic opponent. For LeBon to win again, he'd need a significant amount of Nash's second-choice votes. But Nash campaigned encouraging her voters not to rank LeBon at all. Dybert, who's been teaching third grade full-time throughout her campaign, says the lack of unity between her Republican opponents is a boost.
I feel pretty good. So I'm able to, like, sleep at night and continue to focus on the classroom.
Still in the midst of an Anchorage State House race, Democrat Denny Wells also has almost half the vote and two Republican opponents behind him. He says he went into election night knowing he probably wouldn't have a definitive answer.
I'm in the same boat that I walked into that day with, which is it'll be close, and we'll know on the 23rd, and we're still there.
Since then, Wells has been tracking each incremental update to the ballot count in a spreadsheet to try to suss out his chances. And he says he's optimistic. He's had a little time to breathe and spend time with family after the intensity of campaigning, and now he's thinking about what's next.
What's the literal next step I need to take to work out logistics of going to Juneau, because never having done it, like, it's going to be all a new learning curve.
The Division of Elections will do a final count of overseas absentee ballots on Wednesday. If no candidate in a given race reaches more than 50% of the vote, the division will tabulate second, third, and in some cases, fourth choice votes to determine a winner. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Kavitha George.
The Food Bank of Alaska handed out as many as 10,000 free frozen turkeys and holiday meal kits over the last few days in Anchorage and the Mat-Su. With emergency pandemic benefits phasing out, Food Bank officials anticipated that demand would be up this year at its annual Thanksgiving blessing events. Alaska Public Media's Jeremy Shea visited one of six distribution sites in Anchorage today for this story.
I'm gonna hand you this one.
At the Mountain View Community Center, the line stretched around the block well before the food bank's Thanksgiving blessing event began. Maria Mora is here to pick up food for her family. She's walking gingerly, ground is icy, and her grandmother clings to her side as they make their way to the back of a big truck where volunteers are unloading boxes of food.
What does that mean? This means a lot. That means support a family, especially when you go to see the price on Costco, $82.
For a turkey.
And I say, wow, how can we buy that for the family and then plus everything else? Mm-hmm. So then now here we can get it for free because community help. That's a blessing. It is.
She says COVID-19 made everything harder. And of course, there's inflation. The Wall Street Journal reports that turkeys cost about 30% more than last year and that the cost of an entire Thanksgiving meal is up about 14%. Rebecca Geyer works for the food bank.
A lot of families, you know, have to save their money for bills or their utilities. So by providing this event, we're able to help them so they can make their dollar go a little bit further.
Inside the community center, there's a procession of volunteers who call themselves personal shoppers, queuing up with grocery carts to help residents pick up dry and canned goods from aisles with Thanksgiving sides. There's stuffing, canned corn and green beans, fresh potatoes and apples, and roasting pans for the turkeys at the end of the line. Literally tons of food on tables and shipping pallets to be given away. This is one of six distribution sites in Anchorage. Five other sites held one of these Thanksgiving blessing events on Saturday in the Mat-Su. Paula Green is running this one, where about 300 people will volunteer in shifts over the day. Her church, New Hope Baptist, next door, held food drives to collect the ingredients for the sides for this event.
I think as a body, we love to do community service. You know, we do a mobile food pantry, a food bank every Friday. So this is just another extension of that opportunity to just serve the community.
Anchorage Mayor Dave Bronson is among the volunteers.
I thought it was a good effort to come out and support.
Yeah.
You know, giving some food to some folks that need a little extra help this time of year, and who knows, maybe next year it's us, so let's pay it forward, you know?
The food bank estimates about 1 in 8 Alaskans struggles with hunger. More information on offering help or getting help is available at foodbankofalaska.org. In Anchorage, I'm Jeremy Shea.
An Anchorage teen faces murder charges in a drive-by shooting last week that left another teen dead. The alleged shooter, 17-year-old Zachariah Musa, has been charged as an adult in the November 15th death of 16-year-old Jersey Miller. Two other juveniles in the car with Musa are also charged in the case but haven't been named by police. According to a charging document, Musa was selling puff bars, which are vape cartridges sometimes infused with THC or nicotine. Police say he and the other suspects planned to rob Miller, then drove to a neighborhood in South Anchorage and confronted him from the car. That's when police say the vehicle drove past Miller as Musa shot Miller from the back seat. Surveillance video of the car from nearby homes helped police track it to East 20th Avenue, where they found the car's other passenger. That 15-year-old boy identified the driver and Musa. Police say Musa admitted to shooting Miller but claimed he meant to fire a warning shot. Miller was struck in the head and died in the street. Mourners have built a shrine to Miller at that site, where his mother was reading condolence letters left by people earlier today. A judge initially set Musa's bail at $250,000 cash. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a beloved holiday star will soon light up in Anchorage.
Yeah, comes in and two snaps, opens it up, and throws a switch.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Sneezing, aching, sweating, and coughing. Who has the time for this misery? You have the power to protect yourself and your community. Boost your defenses this season by getting the flu vaccine. Protect yourself and family. Learn more at vaccinate.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health.
Four black bears seen frequenting East Anchorage homes this year have been euthanized, according to the Department of Fish and Game. Fish and Game biologist Dave Battle says the department got daily calls this summer about the sow and three cubs getting into trash and birdseed.
We've probably got more reports of conflicts with that particular group than probably any other single bear or family group this summer.
Then they started to den under two decks in the area, looking for a place to hibernate. One homeowner tried installing an electric fence, and the other tried building a plywood fence around their deck. Neither kept the bears out. Fish and Game drove them out with bear spray several times.
They would just come out, mess around in the woods nearby for a couple hours and wait for the spray to dissipate, and they would either go back under the same deck or they would go to the other deck, which was about a mile away.
Battle says the bears' reliance on human-provided food in the form of improperly stored trash and birdseed made them more comfortable around humans. Fish and Game decided to euthanize the four bears after analyzing their behavior.
We didn't just kill them for denning under decks. That was the final issue, but it was just the progression of their behavior. And the sow was just getting so comfortable around humans. I could walk up to within 10 feet of her probably. And she's not showing any fear.
The department called zoos and animal rescues around the state and country to try to avoid euthanizing the cubs, but none of them had room. Battle says the average Anchorage homeowner does not have to worry about finding a family of bears under their deck, but he says it's a good idea to remove birdseed from yards in October and November when black and brown bears are preparing to hibernate. He says properly storing trash and birdseed can help Fish and Game avoid having to euthanize more bears in the future. Governor Mike Dunleavy requested $287 million from the federal government last month for fishermen impacted by the Bering Sea snow crab and Bristol Bay red king crab fishery closures. But the current process of getting financial relief to fishermen is cumbersome and takes a long time. As KMXT's Kirsten Dobrath reports, Bering Sea crabbers are hoping the plight of the snow crab population might change the way financial relief is delivered to fishermen.
Gabriel Prout is a second-generation Bering Sea crab fisherman from Kodiak. He owns the FV Silver Spray with his dad and brothers. He says there's one big problem with the current process for handing out fishery disaster funding.
If you're going to have a fishery disaster request program, you should be able to make it so the money is getting into the hands of those affected very, very quickly.
Right now, it takes years for money to reach skippers and their crews. After a governor requests a disaster declaration, it needs to be approved by the U.S. Secretary of Commerce, and Congress needs to appropriate funding. The money goes through several agencies on its way to fishermen who have to apply for a slice of it. And most fishermen have to figure out how to stay in business years before the money hits their bank accounts. Bering Sea crabbers like Prout are following the process closely.
Right now, the big hurdle is basically it's sitting with the Secretary of Commerce and waiting for her approval to sign off on it.
Jamie Gowen is the executive director for the Alaska Bering Sea Crabbers. That's a trade organization that represents the fishery. This year is the second in a row that the king crab fishery is closed, but she says the first ever snow crab closure is devastating.
People are still in shock. It's been a lot to digest as far as, you know, what comes next.
About 60 vessels go out for Bering Sea snow crab each year. Gowen says skippers and crew still have bills to pay. And without some sort of rapid relief, many won't make it to the next season.
We've been telling Congress that we need money within 6 months to a year for these small businesses to be able to weather this.
Bering Sea crabbers aren't the only ones waiting on the current system. Earlier this year, the U.S. Secretary of Commerce approved more than a dozen disaster requests for fisheries in Alaska, spanning the years 2018 to 2021. At the same time, improving the current fisheries disaster funding process has gotten attention from policymakers. But climate change has made that conversation more complicated. The Arctic is warming more quickly than other parts of the world. That includes coastal Alaska. Researchers don't know for sure what caused the snow crab population's collapse, but they think warming ocean waters caused by climate change had something to do with it. Gunnar Knapp is a retired University of Alaska economics professor who has studied Alaskan fisheries for decades. He says fishermen have always shouldered financial risk, and over the years, many can attest to having good and bad years. But the recent crab fisheries closures highlight just how much climate change is tipping the scales.
Now, with the sort of dramatic changes that are occurring in the global climate and in our waters and in our climate, you know, we don't know whether fisheries that decline will come back.
Senator Lisa Murkowski's office recently announced a working waterfronts framework that seeks input on the disaster funding process. And ideas for fixes have included something similar to crop insurance for farmers. But Knapp says if fisheries are failing more frequently, that might not be the answer.
If the problem is serious enough, then neither private insurance nor government insurance is really going to work because it's just too expensive if whatever has caused the loss of income is sort of happening too regularly.
Alaska Bering Sea Crabbers' Gowen says she's hoping the fishery's total closure will expedite the process of getting money to crabbers, and that the attention the snow crab collapse has gotten will bring about bigger changes for the commercial fishing industry as a whole.
What's happening in our fishery right now, I'm hoping will be a tipping point to creating a new program that's faster and more efficient. Or, you know, reforming the current program.
Biologists say the Bering Sea snow crab population will likely continue to decline for the next few years. Prout, the Kodiak fisherman, says he hopes his family doesn't have to wait that long until there's a better program in place. In Kodiak, I'm Kirsten Dobrath.
The vast majority of Lower Kuskokwim School District students are not proficient in English or math, according to statewide test results. But as KYUK's Nina Kravinsky reports, students may be improving.
According to the statewide Alaska STAR tests, 96% of LKSD students weren't performing at grade level in English, and an even greater 97% were not doing so in math last school year. Superintendent Kimberly Hankins says the pattern of poor test scores after switching to remote school due to COVID has been a national problem.
COVID certainly has lasting impacts on test scores across the country. So the district is not surprised to see lower student assessment scores with the AK STAR.
The district's results are similar to other districts in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. More than 90% of students weren't proficient in language arts or math in any of the six districts in the region. Students in the YK Delta scored significantly lower than the state as a whole. Statewide, about 70% of students weren't proficient in English and about 77% weren't proficient in math. Hankins says for LKSD, she's encouraged that around half of students are meeting growth targets on their statewide MAP, or Measure of Academic Progress tests, for English and math. She says those are the highest percentages they've seen for meeting targets on those tests in the past 8 years.
What we saw this fall with our interim MAP data is a rebound in proficiency levels from a low in 2020-2021. So this is exciting, and I think reflects that our professional development for staff and our student instruction is on the right path.
Hankins thinks part of those results are due to summer programs at LKSD schools this year. She says 400 students across the district participated in those programs this past summer. In Bethel, I'm Nina Kravinsky.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the Westmark Fairbanks Hotel and Conference Center, located in downtown Fairbanks with 400 guest rooms and 1,700 square feet of meeting space. Reservations at westmarkhotels.com. The polls have closed on the November 8th general election. Preliminary results have been released online by the Alaska Division of Elections. Final results will not be posted until Wednesday, November 23rd, giving time for all ballots postmarked by Election Day to be counted, including mail ballots from rural Alaska, from college students in the lower 48, and from Alaskans serving in the military abroad. This message sponsored by Alaskans for Better Elections.
After a heated debate Thursday night, Skagway's Borough Assembly scrapped the alternative mooring plan for 2023. The plan was part of an effort to expand dock capacity to allow large cruise ships to moor at the ore dock, as questions remain about the viability of the town's largest dock. KHNS's Mike Swayze reports.
Skagway's economy is about 95% tourism-based, and most of those visitors come to town via cruise ship. With significant rock slides impacting White Pass and Yukon Route's railroad dock during the 2022 season, the municipality looked to make a move to allow post-Panamax-sized cruise ships with up to 4,000 passengers to dock at the ore dock in 23. Community leaders feared that losing those large ships would be devastating for local businesses. Previously, the Assembly moved to purchase materials and request bids for their alternative mooring project. But on Thursday night, the lowest bid submitted by Skagway-based Hamilton Construction was voted down, effectively killing the short-term project. The six-person Assembly split the vote down the middle 3-3, as Assembly members Hansen, Hilton, and Henry all voted to award the contract. After a heated debate with Hansen, Mayor Andrew Cremata broke the tie and cast the deciding no vote.
We had four responsive bids, Mayor, that all said they could do this aggressive timeline.
I hear
that's four
saying.
Responsive bids.
I also have a manager, I have the chair of finance, I have multiple people from the public. I have Norwegian saying they won't dock on it. I've got Royal Caribbean saying they won't dock on it. The people who are going to use it. I vote no.
Cremata cited significant progress on the rock slide mitigation project above the railroad dock, and the aggressive timeline of the ore dock redesign, he said, was likely to be delayed due to permitting and weather conditions as reasons for his no vote. Both the borough manager and a representative from the contractor overseeing the rock slide mitigation project shared optimism that the mitigation is going so well that it will allow for two ships to dock at the railroad dock in 2023, including a post-Panamax-sized ship. Standard-sized cruise ships would then be able to dock at Ore and Broadway docks. The long-term Ore dock redevelopment plan is still on track to begin in the fall of 2023. Reporting from Skagway, I'm Mike Swayze.
The Federal Environmental Protection Agency is asking people who live in an area near downtown Fairbanks to participate in a first-of-its-kind research project that asks for the public's help in sampling gases from subsurface contamination that might infiltrate their homes. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Researchers hope to get about 30 households in a residential area just west of downtown to help monitor gases from subsurface contamination and naturally occurring radon that may be infiltrating homes through a process called vapor intrusion.
We're looking for volunteers who, one, want to know the condition of their homes, but two, want to help people all over the country who may be exposed to the same chemicals.
Lenny Siegel works with RTI International, a North Carolina-based research institute that the Environmental Protection Agency is contracted to conduct the study. He says EPA's so-called Soil Gas Safe Communities Research Project aims to develop more user-friendly and cost-effective ways to sample the gases in real time.
The idea is to come up with methods that are easier and more efficient to sample the subsoil gas and indoor air so that more places can be studied and more quickly.
The area that'll be studied is bounded by Kellam Street to the west, Cushman Street to the east, and 6th Avenue and Smythe Street to the north and south. The area lies over two plumes of groundwater contaminated with perchloroethylene, or PCE, and other volatile compounds. But this study includes only the larger western plume.
That's a good-sized cluster, and the idea is to have them spread out over the area of the plume. And we're expecting that the levels will vary. You know, we don't want everybody in the same place.
James Fish is the State Department of Environmental Conservation's project manager for the Gaffney Road area-wide groundwater contamination investigation. He says the agency has, since 1997, been studying the contamination, which came from commercial and industrial dry cleaners that operated around Gaffney Road from the 1950s to about 7 years ago. And he says EPA's research project will inform DEC's ongoing work on the contamination.
What EPA is looking to do is expand on what DEC has done and use new tools that would include using radon as a tracer of vapor intrusion, and also encourage a citizen science approach where people can collect and monitor their own data.
Fish says DEC has set up remediation systems in the contaminated area, but he says it'll take at least 10 more years to clean up the mess. And Siegel says, meanwhile, it's the perfect place to conduct this first-of-its-kind EPA research project.
We took a while to figure out where we were going to do this. We were looking at places all over the United States as potential sites, and this one fit the bill.
Siegel says the homeowners selected to participate in the experiment won't have to expend a lot of time and effort. Mainly, they'll have to agree to allow a radon sensor about the size of a thermostat to be installed in their home and smaller temporary monitors to be placed around their houses four or five times over the course of the year-long project.
We're hoping to do a number of other sites in different climates and in different kinds of buildings, but this is the first place where the soil gas safe approach is being taken.
Siegel says EPA hopes to get volunteers set up in time for a first round of sampling next month. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
Anchorage's beloved holiday star atop Mount Gordon Lion will light up on Friday, and now turning it on is easier than ever. The 300-foot-wide star has been a bright sight for Anchorage residents looking north in the winter since the late 1980s. In years past, teams from Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson had to take snow machines up to the star to turn it on and off. It took a lot of time, says Preston Murfin, the civilian electrical work lead.
Depending on the road conditions and then also with the snowcat, because it travels quite a bit slower, from start to finish, you're looking at about a four-hour day.
This year, for the first time, Murfin and others will turn on the star remotely from a heated building about 3 miles away. It's a small switch in a fuse box.
So normally, that's how she would sit. Guy comes in and two snaps, opens it up, and throws the switch.
The new setup means instead of a team having to snow machine to the star the Friday after Thanksgiving, Murfin will simply swing by the remote switch in the morning and flip it on. The switch sends a radio signal to the star that lights it up in under 30 seconds. And next year, Murfin says the switch will be installed at his main building, making the commute even shorter. Another change to the star this year is that rope lights will replace more than 300 individual light bulbs. Murfin says it makes necessary repairs to the star easier to spot.
Each run of the star has two rope lights on it. So should we see one dim or go out, you know exactly what box to go to in order to make the repair.
Anchorage residents can expect the star to begin to shine on Mount Gordon Lion starting at 8 a.m. this Friday. And fun fact, it'll be turned off when the last Iditarod musher crosses the finish line in March. That's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Kavitha George, Jeremy Shea, Chris Clint, and Wesley Early in Anchorage, Kirsten Dobrath in Kodiak, Nina Kravinsky in Bethel, Mike Swayze in Skagway, and Tim Ellis in Delta Junction. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Katie Anastas is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
The polls have closed on the November 8th general election. Preliminary results have been released online by the Alaska Division of Elections. Final results will not be posted until Wednesday, November 23rd, giving time for all ballots postmarked by Election Day to be counted, including mail ballots from rural Alaska, from college students in the lower 48, and from Alaskans serving in the military abroad. This message sponsored by Alaskans for Better Elections.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.